My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
My next guest, Peter Kafka, has been making podcasts for a very long time. He has been the unmistakable voice of Recode Media for a long time, and you also did a recent podcast series on Netflix.
Yeah, that's me.
I can't help you with movies on Netflix.
And no, sorry, Siri. That's fine. Anyway. So I've really enjoyed your shows. What I love about it, and I kind of try to steal the idea when I'm kind of thinking about it, is this super relaxed style that can also be filled with some either really jarring moments or biting points, but you seem so relaxed with your guests that they'll accidentally let their guard down. Is that what you're going for?
Yeah, that's the idea. Back in the days when you could meet people in person, mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys are doing that in Australia, I always insisted that the guests come to the office, even to the point where we would lose guests because they didn't want to travel to wherever the podcast was recording. But I love interviewing people, and I really like podcasting at length, is because you can sit with people, and even though there's a microphone in front of them, they know that it's being taped and it's going to go out, and sometimes there's a public relations person next to them, that if you talk to them for any length, it can feel like you're having a somewhat casual conversation. That's sort of my aspiration, is that this is what it would sound like if we didn't have microphones. Oftentimes that's not the case, but that's what I would like to get.
Yeah, right. There's been a couple that have really stood out over the years. Even actually, just your recent conversation with the Pandora guy. He's such a big dude, isn't he? Did you get to actually see him in real life?
Oh, yeah. Tim, I've known for a very long time. I've wanted to talk to him. Very often I'm interviewing people that I do know and have met in a previous life or at some point earlier in our careers, with the hopes that will make for a better conversation. And I don't know if this came across, but Tim was someone that I had met before Pandora was the Music Genome Project, and he was this nerd with this project that didn't really make any sense. And I'd followed him over the years, and sort of as Pandora got bigger, we spoke less. And so I was hoping it would be sort of a bit of a relaxed conversation. And the truth was, it wasn't like the two of us sitting in a car talking. He had a business he wanted to promote. But yeah. And then, of course, as soon as we got off the microphone, I said, oh, there was a thing I didn't tell you that would have been much more interesting, which often happens with these podcasts. the mic goes off and then someone says, okay, now I can tell you what I really think.
Yeah, my editor has started going off at me for that, because quite often as soon as the thing ends, I start asking all these nerdy questions, and that's the stuff he loves. So he's like, keep it in. So there you go.
Yeah, oftentimes it's the person knows full well that stuff shouldn't be on mic. They don't want it to be on microphone, so it wouldn't matter what kind of question I asked, and they wouldn't answer it until they're not being recorded.
Onto the media. Obviously, we've had a pretty big week, last couple of weeks down here in Australia.
Yeah.
It started as the media code law, and it was very boring in this country. And then suddenly it became the Facebook ban, and everyone cared.
Yeah, it's been on my radar for a while. So I've both been watching it, but also been a little confused by it. And because I've been working on some other projects, I haven't paid as close attention this week as I wanted to. But I have been following both Google and Facebook sort of squaring off against your regulators and also Rupert Murdoch for 6 months or so. I think this has been going on for. And it seemed pretty clear to me that Facebook was going to dig in. If I had to bet, I probably would have bet that it worked out the way it worked out, which is that Facebook was going to dig in and Google would capitulate earlier. But yeah, it's pretty fascinating. And the stakes for, the way I'm viewing it beyond Australia, right? Was what does this mean for Facebook and Google and every other country? And I think that's very much how Facebook and Google are thinking about it.
Yeah, and I totally get that. And it's been interesting, I think, just seeing the cultural differences in the way that Australians and Americans have reported on it. Obviously, some of the Australian press have a lot to gain if the code goes through. So, of course, they're going to be writing positively. It's been fascinating. I think that, once again, there have been so many things in the last year that have really shown a difference between our cultures. And I think that was another one of those moments.
Yeah, I mean, part of it for me is a frustration, and I guess it's something I could solve with actual work, is just not understanding the mechanisms of Australian lawmaking.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll read about, you know, this commission or that code, and it's unclear to me what that means. I'm sure there's versions of that if you're following American politics and law, but I just also assume that somewhat lazily that you guys are exposed to so much more American politics, whether you like it or not, that you've got a better sense of it.
Yeah.
So it was hard for me to sort of figure out, and I would keep calling people up saying, all right, well, when will this next deadline actually happen? And would keep getting pushed off. And it was unclear to me sort of what if you're paying attention to American politics, but not that closely, you'll see someone's introduced a law or introduced a bill. And unless you kind of are really following it, you won't understand whether that thing is a thing that is actually going to happen, mm-hmm. or if it's just basically an extended press release. So for a while, it was unclear to me sort of what was actually happening here. But from the people I talked to at Facebook and Google, they seemed quite clear that it was very serious. They were treating it seriously. It was not just a theoretical exercise.
Yeah, it's for me, I think a lot of the reason people got so angry at Facebook is if it had come straight from the government, then it would have been probably not that popular. But because it came from the ACCC, which is, yeah, like you said, one of the governing bodies here that, you know, no American podcaster should have to ever think about, because it came from them, they are a very well respected organization. And I think that it was always going to be a PR battle, and people just like the ACCC better and think Facebook are jerks.
Yeah, it's funny. The people at Facebook really don't draw any distinction between the ACCC and Rupert Murdoch.
Mm-hmm.
And their contention is that they were essentially negotiating with Rupert Murdoch.
Oh, totally.
Through this Australian agency. And they were frustrated that it wasn't being portrayed that way. And yeah, I mean, we'll see. I mean, it's a knotty thing. What you know, if you zoom back, pull back, what you see is for years and years and years, news publishers saying, hey, Facebook or Google, or really Google and then Facebook, you're hurting our business. You should do something about that. And for a long time, them being told, go pound sand, or whatever your Australian version of that metaphor is. You know, we're giving you traffic. That should be enough. And over time, Facebook and Google gradually giving very small on their ends, but increasingly larger concessions, to the point where they've gotten to the point over the last couple of years through some combination of, I think, them thinking it's the right thing to do, and then very clearly they think it's the politically right thing to do, saying, all right, New York Times and Wall Street Journal and various other people, we will give you some money. Here's a check for your content. This is what you said you want. We were giving you traffic. You didn't want that. Now we're going to give you a check. And you can't possibly complain about that. And Facebook and Google, as your listeners know, make billions and billions of dollars. They can write lots of those checks. And that is the way that they would prefer to do it, which is, how much will it take for you to shut up?
Yeah.
And so that is what I think both of them want to do in Australia and every other country. It's just a matter of, can they basically negotiate directly with the news organizations and write some of them checks of varying size, or are they going to have to, you know, go through some sort of arbitration, which scares them?
Mm. Yeah, and obviously we're a tiny market in the grand scheme of things, but precedent they set down here must terrify them.
Yeah. And everyone else is lining up. And again, you would have to go through each country and explain to me how politically this will happen. I think it's, you know, very unlikely to happen, to have sort of a version of this in the U.S. There's no version of the ACCC in the U.S. There's just state law and federal law. But that clearly, you know, and there's also a version of this that Google and Facebook pine for. And you see them talking about it publicly, which is, just give us a set of global regulations, mm-hmm. about anything, just whether it's hate speech, or how we moderate content, or how we're going to compensate publishers. Just give us a set of rules that we can follow, that we can say we're following. We'll pay you money, and then we can go about our business. And it would be simpler for them. And then also, you know, they don't say this part out loud usually, but it also is really a competitive advantage to them, because whatever rules they have to play by, their competitors have to play by, except they're much better funded. So even when Facebook, I'm just rambling here, but when Facebook got a $5 billion,
I like it.
got a $5 billion fine, was it over the Cambridge Analytica scandal and privacy issues?
And that was like seven seconds of their earnings day.
Yeah, and they're happy to do it. And in theory, they agreed in that settlement to a whole new set of lawyers and regulatory hoops they've got to jump through. But you know, Facebook can hire all the lawyers it needs to, and it can add all the layers of regulation it needs to. It's fine with that. It just wants to sort of get it off its plate.
Mm. Yeah, and obviously our media code was far from perfect, but it speaks to a bigger issue, obviously, and you've just talked about it there, that Peter Kafka, you've been writing about media for God knows how long and talking about it for just as long.
A long time.
Fix the media for me. Give me one business model that you think the bigger publishers can go to.
Well, the current conventional wisdom is that advertising is bad and having people pay for their news or anything else directly is better because it aligns the people who make the content with the people who are consuming the content. And I think that works for lots of different kinds of products, but it can't work for everything. And if you do that, you're going to have... If you follow that all the way, you're basically going to have a very small group of people getting lots and lots of access to lots of information, entertainment, and all kinds of other content. I hate saying content.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone else is going to get very little. And I happen to work for an ads, mostly ad supported business, and podcasting is ad supported. So I'm a little biased here, but I do think there's a way to sort of have some combination of direct contributions from people who consume content and the advertisers who want to reach them that makes it healthier. So that's a long-winded way of saying I think some combination of advertising and subscriptions is a pretty good model. And you know, I was just having a conversation with a colleague about this. I think at least in America, but I assume most other places, where that really doesn't work is for small, middle, you know, basically local news.
Mm-hmm.
That there are not enough people in medium-sized cities, even decent-sized cities and small towns, who are willing to pay to have news gathered and reported and edited and disseminated. And there's not enough advertisers who want to reach those people. And what you're just seeing is just the term is a news desert, where you just have news organizations just literally going out of business or, you know, being whittled down to essentially nothing. And people have been trying to solve that problem. That's a problem I'm very concerned about more than, you know, how the New York Times is going to do, because they're going to do fine.
Yeah. I mean, the New York Times has a great business model and it's doing very well, but it also has just an unbeatable brand. Like I subscribe to the New York Times and I live in Melbourne. It's just one of those things.
Yeah, that's their plan. Yeah, and by the way, you know, we say the New York Times is a great business model and they're killing it, but I am old enough that I remember not very long ago, 2010-ish, where it was reasonable to speculate about whether the New York Times was going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
They were on the edge of, you know, depending on who you listen to, they were on the edge of bankruptcy, and they did have to take a very high interest loan to survive, and it wasn't clear at all that they were going to have this model that was going to work and have people in Melbourne paying subscription fees for them. So, you know, a way of saying that you know, even people who are paid to sort of think about the future often get it wrong.
So when you're thinking about the difference to the industry now to when you first started reporting, overall, is it a better place? I mean, there are success stories, like we just said, of the New York Times. There's some really fascinating stuff happening in podcasting where independent voices that aren't completely crazy get elevated. And then there's the decimation of local news, like you said. Like, when you balance it all out, what do you think of the current media landscape?
The pros and cons are the thing I think about all the time. I think about, you know, how bad it is that there are, you know, in many places no longer local newspapers or equivalents of them, and that nothing has filled their place. And then I think of growing up in the Midwest, in the U.S., and, you know, we actually were kind of fancy, and we had a New York Times delivered to us once a week, and then we had our local paper, but that was it, right? If you wanted to get any other information, you were out of luck, unless it was on the evening news. And the idea that, you know, the internet could deliver to you, you know, a world of information for very little effort and often little cost is great. It has panned out the way the optimists thought, and also the way that it's allowed you to pursue niche interests, and podcasting is a great version of that. That's all great. And then we also know the downside of having Facebook's and Google's designed to spread any kind of information, including disinformation and misinformation, very easily without human intervention. Mm-hmm. That's all the obvious downsides. So it's a mixed bag. We're stuck with it. I think if I had to guess, we're probably better off still, though. I think there's more. I think we're better off having more information than less.
I think it's media literate people are better off because they know where to find the proper sources, and they experience just a wealth of new ways of consuming news. If you were giving advice to young journalists today, would you recommend journalism as a career if someone younger asked you?
I don't know about a career, but the barrier to entry is non-existent. You can just start typing mm-hmm. or talking immediately. Think about that a lot. About sort of, you know, literally anyone can start a Twitter account or whatever blogging software you want to use or create your own podcast. It's just a click away. It's very likely that no one is going to hear you or read what you made or look at your photo, but they might. And you can practice for free in a way that you couldn't. You have access to printing presses and distribution outlets that just didn't exist back in my day. So that's great. So you don't have those gatekeepers, which means you can try a lot of stuff. It means in theory, you don't have to move to a place like New York to go work in that industry. Although it's pretty interesting, you still have a large concentration of people gathered in Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York who want to do media. And I'm sure you have versions of that in Australia. But, you know, as we just spent a whole year working from home and sort of proving the point that if you want to, you can certainly do this work remotely. So I would certainly go try to do it. I would not wait for someone to give you a job. If there's something you're interested in writing about, reporting on, I would suggest that you go start doing that. You will probably not be very good at it when you start, and you will get better at it over time. And ideally, you'll find people to collaborate with and mentor, and then eventually you should try to get paid to do it because it's a different level, but it's a hell of a lot of fun.
It is. This podcast right now is in that really freaking annoying place where its numbers are going up and it's doing okay, but it's not anything I could live off.
Yeah.
And that's just the hardest bit to kind of break through, I reckon, and it's the same thing. It's like I listened back to the first episode and I'm so fucking embarrassed of some of the way that I was holding back my personality. And I feel I've gotten a little bit better at that, listening to just a shit ton of other people's podcasts and figuring out, not trying to copy them, but just my conversation sounds better when I'm not trying to stumble over myself.
Yeah. And also just how many episodes are you in? How many years in are you now?
Well, I had my first podcast in 2007, but then I took a couple of years off because I had kids. So
yeah, so there you go. So you got a decade-ish of experience, which is great, right? And that's great. I mean, there is a, and I have a version of this too, where you work on something for a while and you kind of like it, but it's not where you want it to be. And people kind of like it, but you'd like more people to listen to it or read it or whatever it is. And so you have that age old question of is what I'm doing working? Is it good? Is it something that I can get in front of more people? I'd like that. Or is the number of people who are consuming what I'm doing the market? And you know, if I want it to be bigger, do I have to make something else? Mm-hmm. And there aren't good answers for that. I mean, I do think it is why you see a lot of my colleagues, including my former coworkers, going to the New York Times, because you go to the New York Times and your reach increases, you know, I don't know if it's exponentially, but, you know, huge increase in the number of people who are going to consume the stuff that you're making, the kind of people who are going to consume the stuff that you're making. I think when I started getting into digital media, you know, sort of Napster era, 2000-ish, there was a lot of ideology around the idea that digital media was going to usurp the conventional gatekeepers. And people keep having that conversation. If it's a new one, it's the, you know, whole Clubhouse conversation right now.
I was going to say,
be an end runner on the New York Times, but yeah. But you know, the New York Times also shows you that there's the attraction of talent there. And they're not paying people the most money ever to work there. People are working there because they want their work to have impact and reach. And so anyway, it's a long way of saying I think a lot of people get to this point where you're sort of having that question, like, should I keep doing what I'm doing? Should I change it? Should I do it somewhere else?
Throw in the bit of Ira Glass cliche thing of him saying that the problem is you've got good taste, so you know your work could be way better.
Nobody tells people who are beginners, and I really wish somebody had told this to me, is that all of us who do creative work, like, you know, we get into it, and we get into it because we have good taste. But it's like there's a gap that for the first couple of years that you're making stuff, what you're making isn't so good, okay? It's not that great. It's trying to be good. It has ambition to be good, but it's not quite that good. But your taste, the thing that got you into the game, your taste is still killer. And your taste is good enough that you can tell that what you're making is kind of a disappointment to you. You know what I mean? A lot of people never get past that phase. A lot of people at that point, they quit. And the thing I would just like say to you with all my heart is that most everybody I know who does interesting creative work, they went through a phase of years where they had really good taste. They could tell what they were making wasn't as good as they wanted it to be. They knew it felt short. It didn't have this special thing that we wanted it to have. And the thing I would say to you is everybody goes through that. And for you to go through it, if you're going through it right now, if you're just getting out of that phase, you got to know it's totally normal. And the most important possible thing you could do is do a lot of work. Do a huge volume of work. Put yourself on a deadline so that every week or every month you know you're going to finish one story. Because it's only by actually going through a volume of work that you're actually going to catch up and close that gap. And the work you're making will be as good as your ambitions. In my case, like I took longer to figure out how to do this than anybody I've ever met. It takes a while. It's going to take you a while. It's normal to take a while. And you just have to fight your way through that. Okay?
Yeah, and you know, and digital media, you know, is in podcasting doesn't have very much of this because it's just kind of a download number. But you know, there's so much in digital media where they can tell you, you know, exactly how much of your story they consumed. They can show you, you know, how much of it, what people looked at on a page, and in very microscopic detail. And sometimes that's super useful because you get feedback about what people are doing, how they're consuming your work, and sometimes it's a little paralyzing. So you're trying to think, oh, how could I increase my numbers here 5%? Could I, you know, the people are searching for this information. Should I write news stories based on Google search?
What do you do? I was chatting to someone just the other day about this for an earlier episode, and they all work in like those big, shiny new places. And I work for a very old newspaper, and I've never seen any of my traffic. And when I said that, they freaked out. They were like, what the hell? Surely you check the numbers all the time. And it's like I open up the podcast download numbers at the end of each week, and each week they're higher, and that makes me happy. But I think if I studied those numbers, I would literally go insane.
Yeah, I think the podcasting numbers are so crude and can't really tell you. And also, again, the number of people who are listening to podcasts is increasing every day, so your numbers should go up. If they're going down, it's a problem. I'd be very interested in like hearing from a producer who could say, look, you've had 5 years of Recode Medias, and we've gone through, and everyone's dropping off at minute 32. Mm. You know, your rambling conversations, let's tighten it up. And I would take that serious. I'm not sure I would do it, but I would certainly think about it. When it comes to writing stories now, in part because my job is not dependent on sort of the traffic I bring in, at least for the moment, I just, I doggedly do not look at those. And you can kind of tell too. You have a sense of when you wrote something good and if people are responding to it. And a lot of times it has to do with whether it's good or not. And sometimes it has to do with whether it got picked up by Google News or Apple News or Facebook distributed.
Oh, totally.
You can try to game some of that, but there's a limit to that.
And don't get me wrong, I do go over the stats and pull my hair out at certain days, but I limit those days again for my own mental health.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Now, when I first started listening to you, it sounded like, I feel like I came to the show a bit late, maybe 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And you had this incredible relaxed swagger. So I assumed you've been doing it for this for a very long time. Have you always just been that relaxed in front of a mic, I guess?
I probably have not, but I started off, first of all, I am old, so I have a little bit of like,
you do mention that quite
before.
A bit.
I'd started off writing and then started interviewing people on stage. for various employers. And then when I went, worked at All Things D with Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher, sort of they had a website, but the main point of their business was they had this annual conference where they brought Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos and did all these heavy hitter interviews. And I thought, oh, that's something I want to do, and tried to figure out how I could build a career where I could talk to people on stage. And so I spent a bunch of years having those conversations and getting better at those. And those, I definitely took me a long time to get better at those. And then, so when podcasting came up, I said, oh, I'm already doing, you know, half hour interviews with important people on stages. I'll just move that over to podcasting. And so I think my initial podcast probably sounded more like me interviewing someone on stage. And I've since sort of figured out, all right, you know, let's try to make it sound more like, it's a different kind of interviewing. Pretty similar, but slightly different.
Yeah, I've heard some people who came across from like professional TV studios really struggled for the first, like they might record 6 or 7 episodes that they don't release because they really struggled with trying to get that new persona that is a persona when you're speaking only to someone's ear holes. You know, it's such a very different thing than someone who might just stumble across your medium.
Although I don't know that, you know, I don't know that there are rules still. I mean, it's still such a new medium, and journalists I like a lot, Dan Primack for Axios, and he's got a newsletter and he's done very well. And he has I can't remember what the podcast is called now, but the whole thing about Axios is they are into brevity. Mm-hmm. So he interviews lots of people that I also interview or would like to interview. And his whole thing is it's done in 10 or 15 minutes. And he's asking, it sounds more like a CNBC interview. You know, it's probably 3 or 4 times the length of a standard TV interview, but it's that. And you know, you kind of get the same information in many cases. And I think, oh, that's very different than what I do. It's just rambling and pauses and circuitous. And I don't think one is better than the other. I like both those things. And if someone, you know, I could also imagine a version where my current podcast and all its shaggy form gets turned into something else. And, you know, as long as it's entertaining and interesting and honest, then I'm all for it.
Well, I mean, the feel of the Netflix miniseries was very different. You could feel the very tight script, and there must have been a lot of editing and so much more. So how was that experience after years of such a relaxed kind of, vibe?
It was great. I loved it. I loved doing it. It was a completely new format for me. It's great to be able to try something brand new in sort of mid-career. It was collaborative. I'm generally, you know, all my writing is, you know, on my own generally. And in the old days before I had an editor, I just hit publish and it would go out. And in the podcast, like, I work with a great producer and an engineer, but it's I drive most of it. And this was with a group of people figuring out a script. And then the interviews, it was funny. I had a producer that I worked with. He said, this is not going to be like a Recode Media interview, Peter. You know, you can't just interrupt people all the time. I said, I get it. You know, we want them to go on at length so we can pull clips of what they said. But on the other hand, it was very interesting because I basically still did a Recode Media interview when I had enough time to talk with someone. I just I interrupted them less. And I had a sort of sense of what I wanted them to talk about, but I also wanted to leave room for them to say something interesting and unexpected. But periodically I would do the interview. My producer would be there. And then he would say, I would say, Zach will never listen to this, but even if he did, it's fine. Do you want to ask any questions? He'd say, yes, I do. And sometimes he would ask them to say something they had already said because he wanted them to say it with a different intonation or hadn't quite gotten it the way he wanted it. And if you've ever been interviewed on TV or sometimes they'll do that, they'll ask you to like say something again. And, you know, everyone was generally for it. And I understood mechanically what it was, but I thought it was pretty funny because I thought, I don't know why you would want to get someone to say something again when they've already said it once, because the first time they said it was the truthful way. But it turns out there's a lot of that. I mean, when you listen to the daily, my understanding is, you know, when they bring in their reporters to talk about whatever they're working on and you hear them for 15 minutes, that's 2 hours plus of taping.
Yeah.
And that's them trying out different stuff and trying out different ideas and trying out different ways of saying it.
Yeah. I mean, what This American Life throws away 80% of its stories or some kind of crazy burn rate like that. Like that's what a team takes to make.
Yeah. And I just finished another episode. We're doing a series on Google. And I'm working on one episode of that, which is on YouTube, which is out next week. And we just finished it.
Oh, cool.
And same thing, you know, I interviewed people for hours and we're taking a line of dialogue from them, which I'm used to doing for a print story. I think they'll be disappointed in the podcast, though, because they'll expect that there was more out of it. But it's great. And it's great. And I'm working with a different group of people, but it's a similar idea. And I hope my enthusiasm for it comes through. It really is fun to get to try not only a different product, but just a different mode of working. Mm-hmm. Has been really refreshing and invigorating for me.
I would highly recommend it. Can you tell the good people at home the story of what Blockbuster had that they let go of? That's how I always recommend people listen to the series.
Yeah, people love that episode too. It's great. There's a bit of like, partly because it's a great story and partly there's nostalgia. But in the old days, if you wanted to watch a movie and you didn't see it in the movie theater, you could go to Blockbuster in America and rent a video cassette and eventually DVDs. And you probably didn't get the DVD or cassette that you wanted, and you would probably get a big late fee. That's how they made all their money. And anyway, they owned home video. And then Netflix showed up with this really clunky, nerdy way of delivering DVDs to your house, which in a lot...
It still blew my mind.
Yeah.
Like when I was visiting America and I was visiting a mate there and he said, hey, what do you want to watch tomorrow? Because we'd been in like film school and stuff in years ago. And so we were big film nerds. And I was like, what do you mean tomorrow? Like you live in the sticks. Then a DVD came out and it blew my mind because that's...
Yeah. So that's, and that was their main appeal early on, was sort of, you had to be a nerd period because you had to like, you know, figure out how to get this thing over the internet delivered to you. But also Netflix, both because they knew who their audience was and also they knew they weren't going to... What you went to Blockbuster for was whatever the big Tom Cruise movie that was out.
Yeah, 48 copies of it.
6 months ago. Yeah, and they knew to get all those copies and you would probably get a copy of that. And so the Netflix didn't need to replicate that. But for you and me, we could get, you know, however many different versions of Apocalypse Now and all this stuff. And they figured out how to stock enough of that stuff and deliver it to you. And I'm telling the whole story here. But the short end of Blockbuster figured out that Netflix was a competitor for them and eventually started to compete with them. And then sort of stopped competing with them right at the moment where they had Netflix on the run. Yeah. And if they pushed it a little further, the Netflix wouldn't be here.
Yeah, yeah. Tell your editors, the tension in that is great. Even though you know how the story played out in the end, there are so many nostalgia moments in that episode because there's the sound of the Blockbusters. As soon as, like, I was driving somewhere and as soon as she said late fees, I almost drove off the road because I'd forgotten the rage I had on late fees.
It's great. It's a Blockbuster had one of those pre-internet businesses that was great for Blockbuster and kind of crappy for consumers. So at the time you probably didn't, you know, no one was very fond of Blockbuster. Now it's nostalgic because it's not here anymore and it makes you think of things in your past. But the interesting thing to me was that you would think, oh, this is a story of a big old pre-internet company that gets disrupted by this nimble challenger. Mm. And that is partially true. But it's also true that Blockbuster for a long time was ready to snuff out Netflix and would have done it successfully, except it then shot itself in the foot. And that to me is that the surprise of a story like that is what makes it work.
Yeah. And so over the years, who's been the hardest person to get on the show, or is it? Do you no longer have those issues of trying to book someone?
Oh, no. I'm constantly fighting to book someone. And it gets harder, right? Because there are more outlets. There was a period where no one would come on a podcast. They didn't know what a podcast was. And then then people sort of started to get the idea and why they might want to come on. And now everyone's got a podcast. So it's now much harder. There's just much more competition. You know, there's a group of digital media people that pay attention to me. And so they generally want to come on and they've heard their peers come on, which is great. Some of the bigger company CEOs are difficult, but frankly, they're not always that great to talk to because they don't get what they are by being loose and casual and saying interesting things. I found directors are great right now. They're great talkers. They have the gift of gab. They usually have interesting cultural perspective, but also from my interest, they also have a good sense of how the business is changing, of making entertainment. So I have a lot of them on right now.
And what are some of the highlights recently of those conversations?
The favorite one I did recently, it was also a personal one because this was someone I had worked with 20 years ago when we were both fact checkers at Forbes magazine. And I knew him a little bit and he was a nice guy. And after that, we went different ways and hadn't been in touch except that, you know, ambient Facebook way. But it turns out he has turned himself into a Hollywood screenwriter. And it hadn't made a movie until late last year. And then late last year, he had two major movies come out. One is Soul, the Pixar movie, which he wrote. And then he also has a movie called One Night in Miami, which is on Amazon. I'm assuming you guys can get that there.
Yep.
Very different movies, very different products. And it was great because it was all questions I would have asked anyone, but it's also someone who I had a relationship with 20 years ago. So we had a little bit of built-in rapport, and then he's just an interesting, thoughtful guy. He's a Black American at a time when it's interesting to hear a Black American talk about making culture at sort of the very highest level and for a biggest audience. So there was a lot in that interview, and it's kind of my platonic ideal of that interview.
One of the ones that stands out for me, I think there were the writers or maybe directors, because they do have the gift of the gab, on who were part of Wolverine Logan. And it's just such a, like, I've not even seen that movie.
Scott Frank, yeah.
I've not seen that movie, and I've listened to that a bunch of times, because it's just, like, I find how that R-rated comic book movie got made far more entertaining than what the actual movie would be.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. I clicked with him right away, and then he works with Steven Soderbergh a lot, and so we did another interview where he brought Steven Soderbergh to my office and we all talked together, and that was very exciting. And then sometime this summer, publicists who work on his behalf say, oh, Scott Frank has this new show. It's on Netflix. It's about chess. Do you want to have him come on? I thought, oh, Scott's great, but I've had him on a couple times. I don't want to keep bringing the same people back. And I didn't, you know, I don't want to have a show about chess. And then, of course, that became a giant international hit. And I went and emailed him and said, would you like to come talk? And he did. And we had another great conversation. And that was one where, you know, I was kicking myself for not doing it earlier, but it was one of those things where he's great to talk to. We got to talk about what it's like to make a Netflix show. And also because when you make a giant Netflix hit, just the audience that wants to hear about that is so much bigger than a normal show. And so that was fun to do as well.
That totally makes sense to me. And I've had those moments myself because I think the way we have kind of gotten used to consuming media now is just everything is on demand, like podcasting and Netflix, of course. This is not a, you know, original thought by any means, but it's just that, you know, one of my favorite podcasts is a show that I'm routinely 8-12 episodes behind, just because, and then I'll have a day where I can finally catch up because, you know, yeah, that's the kind of show that I want to pay more attention to or something. And so, yeah, it's really weird. Like with the bloody chess show, that's how it was described to me. It was just an old friend sent an SMS saying, fine, I watched it. You should watch the bloody chess show. And that was like 4 weeks later. And yeah, I was like, oh, God damn it. Yeah. This is why the rest of the world pays attention to stuff like this.
Yeah. Now, just because it was popular doesn't mean it's giga. You know, I watched a half an episode of Tiger King and I got it and I don't want to know any more about it. It's fine. I will say, you know, the pandemic, because everyone's working from home. And so, you know, everyone's much more accessible. To put up with, you know, various kinds of audio quality because not everyone is set up to do a podcast at home, but, you know, they definitely have the time. And so you don't have to worry about getting into their office or vice versa or any of that.
So when you can finally do interviews in person, are you going to immediately go back to that?
Yeah, I have been thinking a lot about that. I mean, obviously travel is still going to be restricted and people are going to be, you know, I'm assuming, you know, it'll be harder to get them to come down to Lower Manhattan to the Vox office than it would have been. But I will try to do as many in person as I can. But I think the idea that I will not talk with someone remotely is going to go out the window.
Yeah. Once again, yeah, there was a guy down here who was very famous for that exact policy of he would not do interviews unless they were in the studio. It's been fascinating hearing how he talks about the way his production mindset has changed now. Is there anything that you've found helps break down that ice between two empty Zoom screens or even two disheveled Zoom screens or whatever the...
No, I wish I did. I mean, every time one of these, because usually it's someone who, you know, I'm doing at least one of these a week, but the person I'm talking to doesn't do as many. And I find, I keep going back and forth, like, should I have the camera on so we can at least see each other and communicate that way? Mm-hmm. Is it better if we take it off? Then we're just more of a natural phone conversation. And I did an interview today and I interrupted the person I was talking to multiple times. And, you know, the fifth or sixth time it happened, it was just, it was awkward. So no, I don't have any tips. I wish I did. If you haven't, do you have any you can share with me?
None at all. And I've gone through all of those same things of like, the only reason my camera's off today is my 1 year old or 2 year old now literally punched me in the face the other day. So
you got a shiner?
Yeah, I got a shiner, but that, he's adorable. So that's okay. But
strong kid.
Yeah. Yeah. But I've just been kind of going back and forth between testing everything. Like you said, there are no kind of rules at the moment. So I think anything that you spend way too much time on at this stage is probably a bit silly. Like it's a good time to experiment.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking to you sitting cross-legged on the floor of my bedroom, mm-hmm. which is where I discovered it sounds best. I think mostly because there's a lot of laundry that hasn't got put away. Mm-hmm. But yeah, now people, you know, I see people with the special lighting and all this, and I'm just looking at some laundry because that seems to work pretty well for me.
All right, I'm going to move my computer setup into the laundry. Peter, can you tell the good folks at home your podcasts?
Sure. Recode Media is my weekly production. And then I've also worked on a series we have called Land of the Giants. We've done a series on Amazon, Netflix. Google one is in progress. So you can hear the first two episodes now. And there's more to come. And we have more fascinating big tech companies to tell you about in the future.
Well, thank you so much for your time, mate.
Thanks.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.